C-5. Feathers Antiques, Salida, Colorado. Before any searching began, and at Emma's strict insistence, the Feathers had signed a quickly edited version of the contract she prepared before leaving Birchwood earlier in the day. In exchange for their cooperation and silence, the discovery of the fourth plaque meant that the Feathers were now due to receive a cool $10 million from Timo Fiori. The installment-based payment schedule would hold back the majority of the money for long enough to ensure that the brothers would indeed stay quiet for a period of many years, and it would also simultaneously temper the difficulty of explaining the source of their newfound wealth to anyone who might inquire. Laundering was perhaps too strong a word, but Timo understood the concern and assured Andrew that there would be no problems on that front. He exaggerated only slightly in saying he had more money men on his payroll than he had bones in his body, and he was upfront in sharing his assessment that the brothers' antiques business presented an ideal cover story for significant cash influxes, given the eternal plausibility of big fines and equally big sales. What the contract did not afford the Feather Brothers, as Michael was now learning to his palpable frustration, was a guaranteed right to see the plaque's engravings. Dan would have had no problem in showing them, and no great precautions had been taken thus far. After all, the Feathers had participated fully in the search. But Emma cautiously encouraged him to keep the plaque to himself, and to not even look at the engravings until it was safely back in the car and on its way to Birchwood. Dan ran his hand over the smooth rear surface of the plaque. "We need to check it's actually engraved before we leave," he said. "Check in the car," Emma replied. "We don't want to involve them in anything we don't have to, especially when we wouldn't know what the anything is until it was too late."
"I'd say we're already pretty involved," Michael protested. "After all, we did help you find the damn thing, and what exactly is it that you think could be on there that you don't want us to see?"
Emma didn't back down. "You'll be paid millions of dollars per hour for that help once the plaque's origin is verified," she said. "And as for your second question, I'll refer you to what I just said. We don't know what it's going to say. That's the point."
Andrew Feather encouraged his brother to drop this point, telling him that Dan wasn't going to keep the plaque's message a secret for long, and that they would see the engraving when everyone else did. Michael eventually accepted this without looking too pleased. Clark directed Tara to an old shopping bag on the floor and asked if she could hand it to Dan. His own injured ribs weren't happy with the idea of him bending down to pick it up. Tara rolled the bag into a loose ball and tossed it to Dan.
"Put it in there without looking at the front," Clark suggested.
Dan hesitated.
"You really think I should carry a message from aliens in an old shopping bag?"
"Well," Andrew Feather interjected with a high-spirited grin, "the Argentines did lift an alien sphere out of the ocean in an old shark cage."
This comment broke the tension and prompted Dan, laughing in the absence of a suitable riposte, to do as Clark said. He surprised himself greatly by not sneaking a look at the engraved side of the plaque. However much anyone else wanted to know what it said, he needed to know even more. And this self-restraint came as a result of his understanding that Emma was right when she said there was no sense in involving the Feathers any more than they already were. His inevitably expressive reaction, one way or the other, would likely have left little to their imagination and made it more difficult to convince Michael to be patient. While the contract didn't guarantee that the Feathers could see the engraving, it likewise didn't expressly state that they couldn't. Dan nevertheless opted to keep it from them, however. Loath to cause Emma any more headaches, and equally reluctant to make the Feathers' job of keeping their mouths shut any more difficult than it had to be by sharing with them the nature of the messenger's latest engravings. With the plaque safely in the bag, Dan lifted the box it had been found inside back up to the empty space on the shelving unit. He then carefully made his way across the makeshift bridge back to the relatively clear side of the overflowing outbuilding. Once back on safe footing, he made a point of shaking both of the brothers' hands and thanking them for their help. If Michael had borne any resentment over not seeing the plaque, it faded in this moment.
"Honored," he said very simply.
Andrew encouraged Dan to hurry up and get home so the plaque could be shared with the world sooner rather than later.
"Because if you think I'm going to sleep before I know what it says," he said with a laugh.
After a quick group photo taken by Michael at Dan's request, the rest of the group's goodbyes were short and sweet. Andrew Feather's final words came as he pointed out how weird it was that the plaque's discovery in the tiny little mountain town of Salida was so in keeping with the final line of the prophecy taken as gospel by countless plaque-hunting finchers. A triad of great discoveries will bridge the gap between soil and star, arising from the shadow of the Alps to delve the depths of the Silver Ocean and gaze upon the rockiest peak that lies beyond. From Toplitz to Miramar to Salida, it had all come to pass. Dan, understanding a lot more than the Feathers about the nature of the first two discoveries, had no idea whether the messengers had paid any heed to this prophecy or whether the fourth plaque had turned up in the Rockies because they were on his doorstep and hence easily reachable. On the one hand, it made sense to him that the messengers might have played along with such a prevalent theory so that the location of the plaque's eventual discovery didn't seem completely random. But on the other, he knew how dangerous it was to make any assumptions about alien motives, thought processes, or philosophies, particularly when it came to considering how the messengers might act based on their own potentially imperfect observational assumptions about how humanity might react to any given action. What counted for now was that the plaque was safely in Dan's possession. So he put such thoughts to the side and held the bag tightly. Outside, everyone quickly retook their seats in Emma's car in the same positions as they had for the outward leg of their trip. At Clark's sensible suggestion, Emma drove a few hundred meters away from the Feathers' home before pulling up and telling Dan that it was safe to open the bag and take a look, without having to worry about stifling any visual or vocal reactions that might follow. "No one watch when I first look," he said quietly, a request rather than an instruction. "I don't want everyone staring at my face." "You want me to grab that bag and look for you?" Clark asked. "Just look." The others afforded more respect to Dan's request, although Emma did briefly gaze into the rearview mirror to gauge his reaction, and Timo did strain his eyes looking to the side as his head faced the window. Dan could hardly blame them. Timo had been through almost as much as he had, and he knew that he wouldn't have survived a week of the IDA leak without Emma. So he didn't repeat his shy request, even though he noticed their peeking. Clark chose to stare rather than peek, while Tara both turned her head away and closed her eyes. An intense feeling of anxious anticipation grew and tumbled around in Dan's stomach. He had felt this only once before, when he'd stood on Winchester Street and gazed down at a manila folder with a label marked Kerguelen. With every fiber of his being, he hoped that the object he now held in his hands would not prove to be another Pandora's box. Beyond anything else, he hoped that the message on this plaque would finally and decisively clean up the mess he had unwittingly unleashed by first picking up that wretched folder and then anonymously sharing its contents online. Everything came down to this. With no further fanfare and no dramatic pause, Dan lifted the plaque from the bag and immediately turned it around to see the front. "It's real," Timo said, betraying his furtive peeking. Dan ignored this neutrally toned comment and took in every detail of the message he was looking at. It took almost no time for the obvious conclusion to be cemented and for his lips to part and share the news. "I was right," he said, unable to contain his excitement. "It's a star map with two scales, one showing the brightest stars as we see them from Earth, and the other zoomed way in to show more. Timo, look, there's a square on the zoomed-out version, and the zoomed-in version shows everything inside that square in more detail. But then there's a small triangle on the close-up showing us exactly where to look, exactly where to go. Emma, I was right." Emma turned to gaze directly at Dan. There had been no gloating in his voice, and there was nothing but joy in her eyes. Almost rendered speechless, Timo gently rubbed his fingertips over the small engraved triangle. Is it really? "Damn right," Dan McCarthy boomed, smiling the widest smile of his post-disclosure life so far. "It's the way to New Kerguelen."